You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus from New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. Good evening, I'm Al Voner, and this is this week's edition of The Public Eye. Hey, you know and I know that the old adage is and has been for so long, if you don't get a college education, then you'll never make it in this world. The foundations of success in many people's eyes are indeed a college education. And you know, there's truth to that. But is the idea that a college education across the spectrum of all people, at least in this country, is it a fair? Do people have access to it? Are there reasons to believe that maybe this idea, this notion that college will lead to the American dream is something other than that? And that's why my guest this week is author and journalist Will Bunch. His new book is After the Ivory Tower Falls. And for the next half hour, we'll be talking with Will Bunch and getting his take on the notion that college education available to all and giving all the opportunity to enhance their lives. Hey, Will, nice to have you with us.
Hey, thanks so much for your interest in the book. It's great to come on and talk about it.
You know, you are one of the few people that actually put between the pages of the book what I think most people, especially folks, Will, who have children entering college for the first time, or maybe the second or third child. I can't even imagine what that must be like financially. But it's a scary time. But throughout our life, I know for me personally, and I think probably the same holds for you or many in our generation, and for generations to come probably, we were told to buckle down, put your nose to the grindstone, otherwise you won't get into college, and if you don't get into college, you won't get a good education, and if you don't get a good education, you'll never get a good job. There's pluses and minuses to all that, but first and foremost, why the book After the Ivory Tower Falls? What was it that caught your interest?
Well, what caught my interest, you know, I've been largely a political journalist my life. I've been covering U.S. presidential elections. The first one I covered was way back in 1984 when Ronald Reagan was running for re-election. So I've been watching U.S. politics for a long time. And, right around, I guess, the turn of the millennium, is the Republican Party under George W. Bush and Newt Gingrich, and during that year started to really take hold in America. I was interested in what was driving the country to the right, and I spent a lot of time. My two eventually college bound kids were in grade school and middle school back in the 2000s, and because of parenting, I spent a ridiculous amount of time in the car, picking them up and driving them around. And I would listen to right-wing talk radio, and like Rush Limbaugh in particular, because he was on in the afternoons when I was doing those things. What I really picked up on was a lot of resentment from his white working-class listeners towards people with college degrees. You know, it was interesting because to me, the big problem in the Rust Belt and in some of these parts of the country was the decline of manufacturing, the fact that big companies were outsourcing jobs to Mexico or China. But, you know, the CEOs of those companies, that's not who the average middle-class American seemed to be angry at. They were angry at people like journalists, such as myself, or people like college professors or Hollywood movie stars, people in what they call the professional managerial class, the PMC. And so I was fascinated by what was driving this. And as I took interest in it, you started to see this in our elections. You started to see the Democratic Party becoming more and more the party of people with college degrees, particularly in the last two presidential elections in 2016 and 2020 when Donald Trump was on the ballot. You saw more and more college-educated white suburban voters who might have voted Republican in past elections going to the Democratic Party. By the same token, the Republicans have really tailored their pitch towards white working-class voters who don't have college degrees. You know, most famously when Donald Trump said after one of his 2016 primary victories that I love the poorly educated, which was a much quoted Trump line, and it's a bit of an oversimplification, but it's true that Republicans have gotten very good at taking this kind of class and education resentment and using it to build up their political movement. So I wanted to explain why that is, because a lot of the political journalism that I read, people were starting to notice that college, whether or not you had a college degree, was becoming the fault line in American politics. But nobody was really explaining why. What is it about college? What is it about this idea, like you said in the open, that higher education is the American dream for families? What is it that went wrong with that idea that caused us to divide politically over whether or not you went to college or got a diploma? And so that's what I try to explore in this book, After the Ivory Tower Falls.
Well, in following along with that, the thing that stuck out for me personally, and you and I talked a little bit about this before the broadcast, is the fact that I think many people have the aspirations, the hope, hopefully the will to go forward and get a college education, because it has been something that's been driven home for so long. What I find, I think it's very easy to see, and I think you'd agree, is that first and foremost, even if somebody, especially working class people, maybe a husband and wife are working one or two jobs, just to keep the roof over the head, the mortgage, the upkeep of the home, keep clothes on the kids. And then you've got to face the reality that a college education today is extraordinarily expensive. So right off the bat, as you mentioned in the book, this notion can cause and has caused a rift or a divisiveness, if you will. But the first thing that came to mind for me is right off the bat, those who are more affluent, those who make more money, will be able to afford college for their children and maybe give them a few choices where others may not be. And that's got to be, and I want to get your sense on that, that's got to build a certain amount of resentment, even if it's a neighbor. I mean, I know in my own neighborhood, one kid goes to Boston College and another one goes to a state college. And, nobody really talks about it openly. But, given a choice, I think everybody wants to be able to send their kids to the best school. So is this part of is this what's happening? Does the cost of college put a wedge between people?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, and you're right that people have become very obsessed, and kind of with good reasons. One of the things I talk about in the book is, I don't want to get too far ahead of myself, but in the 50s, 60s, early 70s, when college was much more affordable, and you had more and more people from the middle class suddenly having the opportunity to go to college and get a bachelor's degree, you had this situation where it's called credentialism, where job recruiters for companies started requiring college degrees for job openings. So they started using both the fact whether or not you went to college, but also I think to some degree what college you went to recruit people for the good jobs that are out there. So for parents, picked up on this, like you said, and it becomes very competitive to not only get your kid into college, because there's community colleges, there's state university systems that are too expensive but more affordable than an elite private university, but the thing is, in this competitive environment, so many parents feel if their kid doesn't go to the perfect school, whether it's NYU, which costs $80,000 a year, or George Washington University or some elite university, that their kid is just going to have a disadvantage his whole life. And, as you know, as a parent yourself, and I know as a parent who raised two kids, it's this anxiety that's there throughout the child, throughout the experience of raising your child, in terms of, am I saving enough money up for this? Is my kid really on the right track? Do I need to put them in an expensive SAT preparation course, you know, so they'll do better on the SATs to get in the right school? Do I need to hire an essay coach so they can write a perfect essay? And, you know, when you start doing that, it's interesting because, you know, when SAT prep or essay coaches get so expensive, it's a perk that upper middle class families can take advantage of that's really not available to working class families that are struggling to get by. So these resentments that we were talking about earlier, you know, that happen in neighborhoods, you know, people in the Rust Belt, in these struggling towns that don't have the greatest public schools, and they don't have the money to hire SAT tutors or essay tutors, they feel that maybe college isn't for them and their family and their kids, and they get this sense of what some experts call economic fatalism, right? That the deck is just stacked against me from the start, and you know that fuels a lot of our political resentment. It fuels the kind of political resentments that created the Donald Trump movement.
Yeah.
So in the book, I try to explain how, you know, our political crisis in this country is in some sense fueled by, you know, these disputes over access to higher education.
Yeah, and no question about it, Will. In fact, you know, so much of the last couple of decades has created this wedge between people depending on socioeconomic circumstance, and it's just making it more difficult to find striking a balance, if you will, across the nation. I want to take a quick pause to let people know that you're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. I'm Al Voner, and this is this week's edition of The Public Eye. My guest this week is author and journalist Will Bunch. His new book is After the Ivory Tower Falls, and we've been talking about the notion that the American dream, of one of the American dreams, is to access to college education, the importance of a college education. Do we put too much emphasis? And what about those who can't afford it? And Will, going back to what you had said, I'm a product of the community college and state college systems. I have no regrets personally, but I know this generation, especially since the onset of social media, many of the kids in local high schools in my area all throughout their senior year, looking at colleges, sending in applications, were FaceTiming, texting, or letting their friends or their enemies in some cases know that, hey, I applied to Harvard, or I applied to, as you said, NYU, and I got in. Did you? Where are you going? And some kids really took that, took it right between the eyes, as they say, felt bad. Parents felt bad. You know, who can come up with $80,000 a year, especially if you've got two, three, possibly four kids? So that certainly didn't help. Doesn't help matters either. But here's the other thing, Will, and I want to get your sense on this. I've got a neighbor whose son was on the fence. He likes to work with his hands, but some of his classmates said that he'll never make a living. Well, he finally chose to go the route of working with his hands. He's now working as an apprentice licensed while he's going to a technical school. And the owner of the company said, if you continue along this road, by the time that you're 25, 26 possibly, you'll easily be making $75,000 a year or more with little to no debt. So there's that camp as well. So I'm thinking that those who have always felt that they were left out because they didn't get into the ivory, and quoting from your book, the ivory tower or the ivory, those big name schools, might do just as well, if not better, but by following their heart and going with what they know best and not necessarily creating a tremendous amount of debt. Does that make sense?
No, it makes total sense. And I very much address that in the book, because I think one of the problems, you know, when we have this national conversation about college, or, you know, the college problem, you know, we focus on the people going to college, but we don't focus on the folks who aren't going to college or who want other options. And I mean, what a lot of college educated people don't realize is that, currently 63% of American adults do not have a bachelor's degree. So that we're talking about a majority, nearly two-thirds, you know, only 37% of adults have a bachelor's degree. Now in the middle, you have a lot of people, you know, like you said, who might have associate's degrees from community college, or you have a lot of people who, you know, who went to college for a year or two, and often because of the economics, because of the high cost, aren't able to finish. You know, they drop out after a year or two, and so you've got a whole diverse range of people, and we're not going to solve either the higher education problem or also the political divisions that come from our higher education problem. You know, we're not going to solve that if we address the needs of everybody who's turning 18 and looking to make their place in the world. So, you know, when we talk about, you know, getting into some of the specifics of how we do college reform, you know, the big conversation this fall has been around student debt and forgiving student debt. And that's an important conversation. And I think that's a good idea. I support that. You know, and then people say correctly, well, if we're going to address student debt, it doesn't make any sense unless we address the high cost of college going forward. And we absolutely need to address that. But, you know, we need to give options for people exactly like in this situation, like your neighbor that you described, you know, that people who want to go to a trade school. I mean, we need to have a free trade school option up there with a free public college option, I think, for kids. And so in the book, After the Ivory Tower Falls, I do a long riff, actually, where I visited this unique institution. It happens to be just coincidentally about 15 minutes from my house outside of Philadelphia. It's called the Williamson School of Trade, and it's a fluke. It's a guy who was a millionaire back in the mid-19th century, who died without any heirs, decided to leave all of his money to found this trade school. At the time, it was for orphans. Now it's for any, you know, male students who apply and get in. And they get this 3-year trade education, and just like your friend found, you know, your neighbor discovered, you know, employers are tripping over themselves to hire these kids who learn skills like carpentry or masonry or landscaping. And like you said, I mean, they can make, you know, $75,000 in jobs like this. And unlike so many of our college graduates, they're doing it often with little or no debt. Although, I mean, right now you can incur debt, college debt, going to trade schools. But you know, most of these kids don't have the debt problem that people go into our 4-year universities have. So in focusing on the solution, I mean, we really absolutely need to focus on that. I mean, one of the things about our current politics that drives me crazy is, you know, you've got all these Republican politicians from these, you know, industrial Rust Belt or rural districts, where their constituents, you know, the kids coming of age in their districts would benefit so much from free trade school, from government help in getting these apprenticeships, like your neighbor got an apprenticeship. And instead of focusing on that, they'd rather fight these culture wars over, you know, free speech on campus, which, you know, is important, but the real issue in college in America isn't as much free speech as the fact that people just don't have access or can't afford college. That's the real college problem in America right now.
And I think, well, the vast majority of Americans would wholeheartedly agree with that. The other thing, there's been, and you know this better than most people, especially for the last decade, tremendous debate back and forth on both sides of the aisle, and it doesn't matter where you are on the political spectrum. There should be free health care, or health care should be all health care should be accessible to all people. And you know, I think most people buy into that. The question is, how do you go about doing it? This is just another example of that. Education, as you talked about, you know, why should one very bright individual, boy or girl, a man or woman, you know, find that they'll never have the opportunity to attend a top-tier school simply because of the cost. But, you know, what I'm getting at, Will, is you bring in college presidents from around the country, and I, you know, going through this process this past year, you know, I really find that it would be extraordinarily difficult to get them to agree that, hey, you have to lower your costs, or, you know, maybe we can do some trade-offs here. You know, the government can give you some tax breaks. Well, they're already nonprofits to begin with in most cases. I don't know if a dialogue, I mean, how do you even go about, what I'm saying is, how do you go about leveling the playing field?
Yeah, well, what I try and do in my book is, you know, the backbone of the book is that I trace the history of college in America since World War II, because World War II is when college really started to take off, you know. Right. But before World War II, only 5% of adults had a college degree, which is, you know, and most adults actually didn't even finish high school. You know, they went to work in factories or farms.
Right.
And things abruptly changed after World War II, and you had this kind of fluke in the GI Bill for returning veterans that gave veterans gave veterans this free college benefit. You know, that was this experiment that was wildly successful. I mean, these returning veterans flooded American universities. They were great students. You know, college professors were terrified at educating these middle-class kids, instead found out they were the best students their schools had ever had. So the golden age of college, you know, was off and running. But ever since World War II, though, we've really had this big debate over two things. One is, you know, what is college or what is higher education for? What's the purpose? Is the purpose just to get a job and train for a career, or is it to, you know, become a better person, develop a philosophy of life, learn critical thinking. So that's the first part. And the second part is, who's responsible for paying for this? Is it a public good, you know, which, you know, K through 12 education in America is a public good, right? If you live in your community, you support the kids of your community getting a K through 12 education, even if you have no children of your own, or even if your children have grown and moved out of the house, you're still paying property taxes every year, right?
To make sure that
system keeps running. But then, at age 18 in America, you know, we tell our young people that they're on their own, even though society has changed, and now having education beyond the age of 18, whether it's, you know, on a college campus or a trade school, is really necessary to have a successful adult in America, but we tell people they're on their own. So my book traces how higher education was close to a public good back in the first couple generations after World War II, kind of up to the 60s. You know, I trace how the campus protests of the 60s against Vietnam and against racial segregation, how that triggered a lot of political backlash that gave support to this idea that maybe college shouldn't be a public good, that it should be privatized. And when I say privatized, I basically just mean, you know, that families and parents and kids are and young people are responsible for the cost of education. That's been the policy in this country. I'll give you an example in my home state of Pennsylvania. If you go back to the 1980s, 1990s, our state public university system was 75% funded by taxpayers, much like our public, you know, K-12 schools would be. And that was the norm in most states. And that's eroded over the last 30 years. Today taxpayers only pay 25% of that cost, and the difference is made up in tuition. You know, so, you know, a middle-class family that wants to send their kid to just a public state university here in Pennsylvania, like Pittstown University or Westchester University, you know, or think of the public universities you have up in New England, like the University of Rhode Island, you know, or University of Massachusetts in Amherst. Kids paying in-state tuition, nevertheless, are expected to spend $10,000-$15,000 a year out of pocket to attend schools like that, even after loans and other financial aid, or even after financial aid. So they're making the difference up by taking out loans, So many young kids will graduate from a place like UMass, but they'll have $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 in debt. And the way the interest rates work, it often goes up instead of down. I mean, it's a crazy system. Without people paying much of attention, America kind of woke up one day and realized that we had this $1.75 trillion mountain of college debt. You know, it's bigger than the amount that all of Americans owe on all of our credit cards.
Right.
It's a college debt crisis. And that's how it happened. So I traced that in the book. So when you talk about, well, how do we fix it? Well, how do we change the conversation again back to where it was in 1946, you know, when we were suddenly talking about making college, higher education opportunities, making them a public good for our young people? You know, where are places where we can change our priorities, you know, whether it's spending less on the Pentagon or taxing Wall Street transactions or imposing a wealth tax? That's what your senator in Massachusetts, Elizabeth Warren, you know, has proposed a wealth tax as a way to pay for free or low-cost public universities.
Right.
You know, do we have the political will to make something like that happen? Because at the end, it's a question of priorities. You know, is building more long-range, bomber jets, is that our priority, or is our priority making sure that young people are educated so that they can understand the threat posed by climate change, so that they won't be susceptible to, you know, conspiracy theories like QAnon or like the big lie, so they won't suddenly find themselves fighting with police officers at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th.
Right.
You know, I mean, these are serious questions. You know, I mean, it's a little abstract, but I think you can't separate our lack of support for educating our young people with, you know, January 6th and some of the other things that have happened in the country. I really don't.
I think as we start to close out, Will, that this is going to be a tremendous debate. You said it yourself. There's no easy answer. But, you know, because there are so many special interests, to coin the phrase, it's going to be a really difficult time for all groups to come together and agree on any one plan. But at the same token, as you pointed out, we've got generations upon generations that are wondering, you know, even if I do go to college, even if I get into college, I'll be straddled with $100,000, $150,000 or more in debt. Where am I going to get employment that's going to pay that off anytime soon? Plus the high cost of buying a home. I'm glad I am where I am in life right now, Will, because to be 18 or 19 and looking forward, and I don't want to, you know, fog up the lens, as they say, but they've got a tough road ahead of them, no question about it. Well, as we wind down, obviously the book is out in wide distribution after the Ivory Tower falls. But if people want to pose questions to you directly or get more information about your work, can they reach out to you directly?
Absolutely. You know, just drop me an email at the Philadelphia Inquirer, where I'm a columnist. My email is wbunch at Inquirer, INQUIRER.com. I'm very active on Twitter. You can follow me at @Will_Bunch. I'm there. And if you go to Inquirer.com/Bunch, you can subscribe to my free weekly newsletter. It can just come to your inbox every Tuesday. I'm working on today's right now as we speak. So there's a lot of ways to stay in touch, and I hope people can check out After the Ivory Tower Falls. You know, it's out. You can also listen to it on Audible if you prefer to listen to books rather than read them. And because people are talking about this, you know, it's funny, even a couple of years ago when I started doing on this, I think it was still an under the radar issue, but now people are really asking questions about how did college get to be like this? How did it get to be so expensive? You know, how did these schools now only, you know, like Harvard, that only 40% of their applicants, and even public universities like Berkeley, for example, are hard for kids to get into, which is, and it's become, like you said, a source of stress for our young people.
Big time.
Our young people are stressed out. They're having a mental, and I think I think that, you know, the stress that this situation has created is a big part of the mental health crisis that our young people are facing.
No question about it, Will. No question about it. Again, I want to thank my guest this week, Will Bunch, in his new book, After the Ivory Tower Falls. A great read, whether you're ready to put someone through college or down the road, a few years, just opening your eyes to what is the reality going forward in some of the pitfalls and many of the challenges that folks will have to face when it does come to higher education here in this country. But again, I want to thank Will Bunch for joining us this week. And again, I want to thank you for tuning in to 90.5 WICN. For the Public Eye, this is Al Vona. Thank you so much.